Okay, 1 John chapter 5 and verses 4 and 5 will be the text for the message I would like to preach to you this morning. 1 John chapter 5 and verses 4 and 5, which indeed I'm sure will be familiar verses to all of you. You've read them or heard them before. 1 John 5 and verse 4, it says, "Whatever is born of God overcomes the world, and this is the victory that has overcome the world, our faith. And who is the one who overcomes the world? But he who believes that Yeshua is the Son of God." Note that there's three things in that those particular two verses that says overcomes the world. First, we must be born again, and that's very important. And I want to emphasize that here at the beginning because I don't want it to be left for granted as we go through the rest of this message. I'm talking to people, I'm not only going to speak this morning to you people about faith, but I want to speak to you also that it is vitally important that we be born again in Yeshua the Christ. And there is much that there are many good, meaning, patriot-minded people who are promoting great programs, but I'll guarantee you they will flop unless indeed we are born again, because it's very clear in that first verse. It says, "For whatever is born of God overcomes the world." It doesn't just take faith. Faith indeed is an integral part, but we must be born again believers. It is faith, though, through all of it, that overcomes the world. Here in these verses, we're told that it is our faith that overcomes the world. But wouldn't it be just as accurate to say that it is our faith which overcomes what we fear from the new world order? You may be thinking to yourself, well, what's the difference? Well, I'm convinced that today's Christians are overcome much more often simply by what they fear the new world order will do to them, rather than actually what it is or has been doing to them. Now, hopefully you can see the difference between the two. When we fear, just what is it that we fear? I want you to think about that. When we fear, just what is it that we fear? Well, sometimes what we fear is simply nothing at all. In light of God, as the supreme ruler of all the universe, what we usually fear is at least very little. But sometimes what we fear is nothing at all. As I pointed out in the last message, far too often we as a people fear that which never happens. Over 90% of the things that we have anxiety attacks over never happen, never come to be. I pointed out in the last message how many in recent years since I've been involved, since my eyes have been opened to at least pay attention to world events around me as a Christian, rather than an ostrich with his head tucked in a sand hole. But since I started to look and listen a little bit, how many things have I heard in the last several years, things that Christians and patriots have been concerned about that have never come to be? I pointed out several in last week's message. To put it another way, we fear quote unquote things we create out of nothing. We often look back on those who worshiped idols formed with their own hands, and it amazes us how people could be so foolish. As I once pointed out in one of my Jubilee articles, to worship an idol is the epitome of stupidity. However, to fear, to worship is bad enough, but to fear that which we ourselves have made with our hands is even more foolish. But the real, the true epitome of stupidity is to fear that which we have quote-unquote created by our own imagination. That's the real epitome of stupidity. Now let me ask you, what was it that defeated the Israelites at Kadesh Barnea? What was it that kept them from going into the promised land and taking dominion? I wonder how many people would say the giants. Well, if you're one of those who would say it was the giants that kept them out of Canaan, you're absolutely right. It was the giants. However, it was not the giants in Canaan land. It was the giants in their own minds. Listen carefully to the report of the 10 faithless spies as found in Numbers chapter 13. Numbers chapter 13, and let me begin by reading, beginning with verse 25. It says, "When they returned from spying out the land at the end of 40 days, they proceeded to come to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation of the sons of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. And they brought back word to them and to all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. Thus they told them and said, 'We went into the land where you sent us, and it certainly does flow with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. Nevertheless, the people who live in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. And moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. Amalek is living in the land of the Negev, and the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites are living in the hill country, and the Canaanites are living by the sea and by the side of the Jordan.'" Then, verse 30, "Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, 'We should by all means go and take possession of it, for we shall surely overcome it.'" You can almost see Caleb realizing that here is these other men, one of them at least, speaking for the other nine, speaking and all of a sudden appearing to give a good report at first, and then all of a sudden he could probably look out in the people, look out to the audience of people out there, the multitudes of the Israelites, and all of a sudden start to see the fear and the anxiety attacks starting to take over. Because he's talking about the Jebusites, the Canaanites, the Anak, and all of these others that are living in there, and their strong cities and so forth. And all of a sudden, he quiets the people that they had already begun to grumble and complain by that point. But it says, "Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, 'We should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we shall surely overcome it.'" But then notice what it says. It says, "But the men who had gone up with him said, 'We are not able to go up against the people, for they are too strong for us.'" One exemplified, Caleb and Joshua, I should say, two exemplified faith. The rest exemplified doubt. And then they said, "So they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, 'The land through which we have gone in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great size. There also we saw the Nephilim. The sons of Anak are part of the Nephilim. And we became like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight.'" You're absolutely right if you say it was the giants that kept the Israelites out of the promised land. But indeed, it was not the giants of the land, but the giants in their own minds. Did you catch the emphasis of what's said in the last part of Numbers chapter 14, the last part of the last verse? Note again, here's what it says. It says, "We became like grasshoppers." Listen to this. I want to emphasize. I want you to hear this, okay? Listen to what it says. It says, "We became like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight." I don't know if you ever saw that before, but I think it says a lot. It needs to speak to us volumes. Others nearly always think of us as we think of ourselves. If we appear or present ourselves as being grasshoppers, weak, non-confident, fearful, and faithless, then our enemies will see us the very same way. It was only because they appeared to be grasshoppers in their own sight, and obviously started acting like grasshoppers, that they became grasshoppers in the sight of the rest of those in Canaan as well. On the other hand, if we present ourselves as giants, strong, beaming with confidence, courageous, and loaded with faith, then our enemies also will view us in the same fashion. There's quite a lesson there for us to learn. And isn't that what we're being told to do in these two passages, beginning with Ecclesiastes, chapter 10 and verse 4. Ecclesiastes 10 and verse 4. Listen to what this says. It says, "If the ruler's temper rises against you, do not abandon your position, because composure allies great offenses." You can have all the great offenses. I mean, you can be armed to the teeth, But I'll guarantee if you don't have a little composure when you're armed, the enemy isn't going to be too concerned about how you're armed. But composure, don't abandon your position just because a ruler's temper rises against you. And these are the days in which we live are indeed again days when our ruler's tempers are sometimes rising against us. Also turn to Philippians 1. I seem to keep coming back to this passage. I've used it twice to end two recent messages, all for different reasons. But let's look at it again. Philippians chapter 1 and verses 27 and 28. It says, "Only conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of the Christ." I think just stay standing strong in our position, standing in our faith. Couldn't you call that conducting yourselves in a worthy manner of the gospel of the Christ? Going on, it says, "So that whether I come to and see you or remain absent, I may hear of you that you are standing firm in one spirit with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel." Verse 28, "In no way alarmed by your opponents." Listen to the last part. It says, "Which is a sign of destruction for them, but of salvation for you. And that too from God." Indeed, they will see us as we see ourselves. And I want to tell you something, and I want you to remember this. We strengthen the hands of our enemies when we fear them. We strengthen their hands. And they will indeed feed off of that fear as well. Matter of fact, they feed the fear. Because they get strength, they are strengthening themselves from it. You know, most warfare is won not on the battlefield, but in the mind, psychologically. It's actually won many times, many battles, probably most battles, are normally won before the battle ever begins. Think about Goliath and Saul's army. He had beat them psychologically, without even raising one little, I guess I should say one large finger, since he was a giant, against them. He had already beat them. He didn't even have to fight them. He had already beat them. They were cowering in their holes. But thank God David understood about psychological warfare. Turn to 1 Samuel chapter 17. Verses 45 through 48. Listen as David approaches Goliath. As David had taken up his challenge, when David had refused to be overcome by Goliath's psychological warfare tactics, here's what it says. You talk about psychological, you listen to these words. 1 Samuel 17, verses 45 through 48. It says, "Then David said to the Philistine, 'You come to me with a sword and a spear and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of Yahweh of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have taunted. This day Yahweh will deliver you up into my hands, and I will strike you down and remove your head from you. And I will give the dead bodies of the army of the Philistines this day to the birds of the sky and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. And that all this assembly may know that Yahweh does not deliver by sword or by spear, for the battle is Yahweh's, and he will give you into our hands.' Then it happened, when the Philistine rose and came and drew near to meet David, that David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine." And of course, you know the end of the story. Can you imagine? Just picture that. Here's this small little shepherd boy, dressed as shepherd boys would be dressed. He doesn't have armor on. He doesn't have a spear. He doesn't have a shield. He doesn't have a bow. He just simply is running forward with a little small sling in his hand and a pouch full of flat rocks. And he comes out with the statement to that giant that he just made. Now, I don't know about you, but I believe that the faith and confidence of this small, armorless shepherd boy had a psychological effect on Goliath. It doesn't tell us that But I have to believe. I mean, he had scared all the armies, and yet this one little boy comes out with more confidence than all the army had together. I have to believe he was psychologically affected, possibly just enough to cause him to hesitate just a moment too long, which gave David the edge and the time to sink one of those flat rocks in his temple and put him to death and bring about the victory. You know, could it be that that is also why there was no real battle for the American forces in Iraq 2 years ago? Could it be that Saddam Hussein and his army were already defeated psychologically? You know, they literally just didn't fight. They literally gave up. Could it be that they were possibly defeated psychologically? They were defeated so badly psychologically that they didn't even put up a fight. Could it be that they fell for all the American propaganda? And that is why they never even began to fight. Now, there might have been a deal cut. It's certainly true and possible that there may have been a deal cut between King Hussein and President Bush. But that doesn't begin to explain why his army didn't fight. Why they gave up before the first shots were hardly even fired. You know, I think they had been whipped again psychologically. Both Shalmaneser and Sennacherib, kings of Assyria, understood the power of psychological warfare. That's why they did their best to shake King Hezekiah's faith and confidence before they attacked Jerusalem. If you ever want a model for psychological warfare, Rabshakeh, both Shalmaneser's and Sennacherib's military negotiator, provides it. Turn with me to 2 Kings chapter 18. 2 Kings chapter 18, beginning with verse 17. Listen to this, these words. Now, at this point, Shalmaneser's Assyrian army has surrounded Jerusalem, has got them outnumbered, has got them basically beat if it ever comes to a fight, at least in their eyes. And listen to these, the words, the psychological tactics, the psychological warfare of this Rabshakeh, Shalmaneser's military negotiator. Starting with verse 17, it says, "Then the king of Assyria sent Tartan and Rabsaris and Rabshakeh from Lachish to King Hezekiah with a large army to Jerusalem. So they went up and came to Jerusalem, and when they went up, they came and stood by the conduit of the upper pool, which is on the highway of the Fuller's Field. When they called to the king Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, and Shebna the scribe and Joah the son of Asaph the recorder came out to them. Then Rabshakeh said to them, Say now to Hezekiah, thus says the great king, the king of Assyria, what is this confidence that you have? You say, but they are only empty words, I have counsel and strength for the war. Now on whom do you rely that you have rebelled against me? Now behold, you rely on the staff of this crushed reed, even on Egypt, on which if a man leans, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who rely on him. But if you say to me, we trust in Yahweh our God, is it not he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah has taken away, and has said to Judah and to Jerusalem, you shall worship before this altar in Jerusalem? Now therefore, come, make a bargain with my master, the king of Assyria, and I will give you 2,000 horses if you are able on your part to set riders on them. How then can you repulse one official of the least of my master's servants and rely on Egypt for chariots and for horsemen? Have I now come up without Yahweh's approval against this high place to destroy it? Yahweh said to me, go up against this land and destroy it." Notice the disinformation that he's giving throughout this as well. Verse 26, "Then Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, and Shebna, and Joash said to Rabshakeh, speak now to your servants in Aramaic, for we understand it, and do not speak with us in Judean in the hearing of the people who are still on the wall. But Rabshakeh said to them, has my master sent me only to your master and to you to speak these words, and not to the men who sit on the wall doomed to eat their own dung and drink their own urine with you? Then Rabshakeh stood up and cried with a loud voice in Judean, saying, Hear the word of the great king, the king of Assyria. Thus says the king, Do not let Hezekiah deceive you, for he will not be able to deliver you from my hand. Nor let Hezekiah make you trust in Yahweh, saying, Yahweh will surely deliver us, and this city shall not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. Do not listen to Hezekiah, for thus says the king of Assyria, Make your peace with me and come out to me, and eat each of his vine and each of his fig tree, and drink each of the waters of his own cistern, until I come and take you away to a land like your own land, a land of grain and new wine, a land of bread and vineyards, a land of olive trees and honey, that you may live and not die. But do not listen to Hezekiah when he misleads you, saying, Yahweh will deliver us. Has any of the gods of the nations delivered the land from the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamath and Arpad? Where are the gods of Sepharvaim, Hena and Eva? Have they delivered Samaria from my hand? Who among all the gods of the lands have delivered their land from my hand, that Yahweh should deliver Jerusalem from my hand? And then, shortly later, another king sends Rabshakeh again. And we find nearly the same words, but let me read them to you as well. In chapter 19 and verse 9 through 13, again as an example of psychological warfare, a beautiful model of psychological warfare. I mean, in that last speech, you had everything. Disinformation. You had information to make them doubt and shiver. You had information there that would want to make them come onto their side and receive all the great benefits that he so adequately described. He goes on now for King Sennacherib's, for his sake, he says in verses 9 through 13 of chapter 19, he says, When he heard them say concerning Tirhakah, king of Cush, Behold, he has come out to fight against you. It says that he sent, speaking of Sennacherib, messengers again to Hezekiah, saying, Thus you shall say to Hezekiah, king of Judah, Do not let your God in whom you trust deceive you, saying, Jerusalem shall not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. Behold, you have heard what the kings of Assyria have done to all the lands, destroying them completely. So will you be spared? Did the gods of those nations which my fathers destroyed deliver them, even Gozan and Haran and Rezeph and the sons of Eden who were in Telassar? Where is the king of Hamath, the king of Arpad, the king of the city of Sepharvaim, and Hena and Eva now? Of course, they were in Assyrian captivity. Beautiful model of psychological warfare. Those are one of the most brilliant pieces of psychological warfare that I believe you'll probably ever run across. However, thank God that Hezekiah was a man of enough faith so as not to fall for Rabshakeh's false words. How I wish I could say that about our people today. That they were men and women of faith enough to not fall for the false words that's being fed them in this psychological warfare that indeed you and I are being faced with every day of our lives today as Christians. But thank God that it could be said about Hezekiah. In both cases, Hezekiah psychologically overcame his enemies, or at least his own fears. Would you like to know how he did it? Well, it's such a simple answer that it's often underestimated and completely overlooked. He did so simply by faithful prayer. Turn to 2 Kings 19 and verse 1. We find there, it says, And when Hezekiah, this is after the first attack, after Rabshakeh's first psychological tactics, it says, And when King Hezekiah heard it, he tore his clothes and covered himself with sackcloth and entered the house of Yahweh. Excuse me, this is only after Sennacherib's the last. And then also look at verse 14. It says, Then Hezekiah took the letter from the hand of the messengers and read it, the one from Rabshakeh, and went up to the house of Yahweh and spread it out before Yahweh. I want you to let those last words sink into your soul. He spread it out before Yahweh. That's the same thing we're told to do in Psalms 55 and verse 22, where it says, Cast your burden upon Yahweh, and he will sustain you. He will never allow the righteous to be shaken. But honestly, How often do we do the same? Spreading it out before Yahweh or casting it upon Yahweh means to completely let go of it and put it in Yahweh's hands. Whatever it is that we're having some anxiety attack over, whatever fear that may be starting to overcome us, how many times do we completely let go of it and put it in Yahweh's hands? We don't very often do that, do we? No, we hold on to those fears. And we brood over them. And we let them fester and grow in our souls until rather than we controlling our fears, they control us. And let me remind you, whatever controls us becomes our God at that moment. In Romans 6 and verse 16, we find these words. It says, "Do you not know that when you present yourselves to someone as slaves for obedience, you are slaves to the one whom you obey, either of sin resulting in death or of obedience resulting in righteousness?" Fits fear perfectly. Can't you now see why God requires that we fear Him? People wonder, why would God want us to fear Him? He wants us to love Him, but the Scriptures far more times tell us to fear Him than they tell us to love Him. But can't you start to begin to see why God would require that we fear Him? Because whatever we fear most, even a figment of our imagination, is what we will eventually obey. And our obedience proves indeed who our God is. And Yahshua reminds us and tells us that you cannot serve two masters, for you'll either hate the one and despise the other, or else you will hold to one, and so forth and so on. You can't do it. Your fear, if nothing else, if love isn't enough to bind you to Yahweh and His Word, if whatever other emotion isn't enough, if faith isn't enough, then fear has got to take over. Because whatever we fear is what indeed we will end up obeying. Spreading it out before Yahweh is again the same thing we also find Peter admonishing us to do in 1 Peter chapter 5. I read it in the last message, but let me do it again. 1 Peter 5 and verses 6 and 7. It says, "Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that He may exalt you at the proper time, casting all your anxiety upon Him." Listen to that. It says casting. What do you do when you cast something? I mean, you completely get rid of it. If I take something of mine and I cast it upon you, it's no longer mine, it's yours. And he says that's what we're to do. After humbling ourselves, we are to cast all our anxieties upon Him because He cares for you or us. We are indeed. Yes, we do need to humble ourselves and cast our anxieties upon Him. However, let me also remind you that we are not limited to only praying. Praying alone can sometimes be just a cop-out. God sometimes expects us to do more than just praying. And as I pointed out, the very next two verses that follow up with what I just read from Peter point that very thing out. Look at verses 8 and 9. Or excuse me, 9 and... Let me see what I've got here. 9 and 10. Or just verse 9, it says, "But resist him, firm in your faith." Excuse me, it needs to be 8 and 9. Verse 8, "Be of sober spirit, be on the alert. Your adversary," or your opponent at law, the devil, the false accuser, "prowls about like a roaring lion." In other words, like Shalmaneser and Sennacherib. They were called lions, weren't they, in Jeremiah. "Seeking someone to devour." And as I pointed out, those descriptions do not fit some red-skinned, forked-tailed creature that you never see. That is a description of their great deceiver, their false accusing opponent at law, Herod. And then notice what it says. They were to cast. They had many anxieties. They had real anxieties. I mean, these people get excited, or they may have anxiety, what they think are anxiety attacks because of this Satan creature they have, basically as a figment of their imagination for the most part. But I want to tell you, these people had real anxiety attacks. over what Herod was and would be doing to them in the future. James had had his head cut off. And untold number of things that Herod and his administration were doing to the people. Yes, we are to cast our anxieties upon him. And yes, we are to do it in prayer. But God intends us to do sometimes more than that as well. Because look at the next verse. Verse 9 again, it says, "But resist him, firm in your faith, knowing that the same experiences of sufferings are being accomplished by your brethren who are in the world." God indeed intends us to be men and women of prayer, men and women of faith. But sometimes he expects that faith to also produce action on our part. In this case, they were told to resist this roaring lion called Herod. Hezekiah's faith to spread it out before Yahweh is what overcame Sennacherib and his quote-unquote new world order he had planned for the Israelites at that time. And on that alone, Yahweh honored his faith and with one angel wiped out 185,000 Assyrian soldiers in one night. However, Hezekiah obviously also understood that it was not a lack of faith on his part to also make physical preparations for war. Just in case, God chose to use him and his army to defeat the Assyrians instead of what he did. Turn to 2 Chronicles in this case, in chapter 32. 2 Chronicles 32, verses 1 through 5. Listen to this. After these acts of faithfulness, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came and invaded Judah and besieged the fortified cities and thought to break into them for himself. Now when Hezekiah saw that Sennacherib had come and that he intended to make war on Jerusalem, he decided with his officers and his warriors to cut off the supply of water from the springs which were outside the city, and they helped him. So many people assembled and stopped up all the springs in the stream which flowed through the region, saying, "Why should the kings of Assyria come and find abundant water?" Notice the provisions for war that are beginning to be made. And then verse 5, it says, "And he took courage, and he rebuilt all the wall that had been broken down, and erected towers on it, and built another outside wall, and strengthened the Milo in the city of David, and made weapons and shields in great number." How would you describe in today's term what Hezekiah was doing in what I just read in the last verse? He said that he made weapons and shields in great number. One of those non-politically correct terms. It's called stockpiling. He stockpiled weapons because he knew he had enemies that were very possibly planning to attack him. He provided. He didn't just stand back, and he didn't just pray, go into the temple of Yahweh and simply pray. He also put his faith into action as well. Nevertheless, it is extremely important that we ourselves, in any physical preparations that we might find ourselves making, heed what Hezekiah next says to his people. He makes the physical preparations, but listen to then what he says to his people in the next three verses. Verse 6, it says, "And he appointed military officers over the people, and gathered them to him in the square at the city gate, and spoke encouragingly to them, saying, 'Be strong and courageous. Do not fear or be dismayed because of the king of Assyria, nor because of all the multitude which is with him.' Then he says, 'For the one with us is greater than the one with him.'" What are we told in 1 John 4 and verse 4 in the New Testament? It says, "Greater is he that is in us than he that is in the world." Same thing. Who is it, he that is in the world? Well, I believe, even this Satan creature that people believe in isn't normally considered to be in the world. He's considered to be in the spirit world. I think, again, he was talking about that the one in us, the one that abides in us through his Holy Spirit, is greater than he, the great accuser, Herod, or anyone else that may be in the day and age that we happen to be dealing with. Greater is he that is with us in this battle than he that is in this world. And then in verse 8 it says, "With him is only the arm of the flesh, but with us is Yahweh our God to help us and fight our battles." We need to heed those thoughts. Yes, indeed, it is not a lack of faith for us to make physical preparations, but at the same time, we better heed those warnings. Let us never forget that God does at times choose to use the arm of the flesh to achieve His victories, but the arm of the flesh alone will never, or through the arm of the flesh alone, victory will never be secured. It is by our faith, once again, that we overcome this world order. You know, now it's understood that if something is true, that the reverse of that truth is just as true as well. If it is our faith that overcomes the world, then it can safely be said that we will never overcome this world order without faith. And don't think that our enemies don't understand that and aren't taking advantage of that as well. Consequently, the destruction of our faith is the aim of their psychological attacks. You know, you have to wonder how many battles in the past which would have been won were lost simply because of never being fought because of fear or its equivalent, the lack of faith. You know, we've already read about one in Numbers chapter 13 when the Israelites were being told to go in at Kadesh Barnea the first time into the land of Canaan. They would have won that victory. The victory was already theirs. Isn't the victory already ours too? But the victory was already theirs. But they didn't even go in and engage in battle because of their fears. The battle was lost simply because of them creating out of nothing something they feared. You know, had Hezekiah believed Rabshakeh rather than God, we would have never heard of angel power. I mean, God didn't even use him in that case. We would have never heard of angel power. That one angel, just one angel, can kill 185,000 soldiers in one night. And I've shared with you how many in the past, how many angels were at Yeshua's disposal in the garden. And you multiply it out and it's 4 billion, over 4 billion. The ability of over 4 billion soldiers in one night to be killed by angel power. Just think if Hezekiah had done what would have been naturally, maybe even his advisors were telling him to do. Very possibly he went to his advisors first. And of course they were calculating the number of the soldiers out there compared to what they had in Jerusalem. I guarantee they were far outnumbered, and they were calculating whether they were going to be able to last with food and water and all the provisions that they may have had. Had he listened to his advisors, or had he listened to the fears in his own heart, just think what would have been lost. Just think what wouldn't have happened. How many battles have been lost the same way? What if David had fallen for Goliath's psychological ploys like the rest of Saul's army? You know, what a great example of faith would have been lost, would have never been recorded in the Bible for our children to read and to be encouraged and strengthened by, for you and I to be encouraged and strengthened by. And how many others have been lost simply because God's people fell for the enemy's psychological warfare? There's no question, Christianity's enemies are winning most of their battles psychologically without ever having to engage in a real battle. Because we just give up. Because we let our fears control us rather than controlling our fears. It's the battle stratagem that was described as far back as 500 years before Christ. Sun Tzu, the Chinese philosopher and general who lived 500 years before Christ, said it this way. He said, quote, "To fight and conquer in all your battles is not supreme excellence. Supreme excellence consists in breaking the enemy's resistance without fighting." And man, is that, if you look across what's called Christendom today, is that ever being accomplished by the enemies of Christianity? They have broken through one means or another, through the false doctrine emanating from the pulpits or from the media moguls and all of the rest, they have broken the backs of Christianity before they've even trampled upon them. Yes, they are the salt of the earth. They don't need to trample upon them. They don't need to knock them down. Because Christianity is willing to lay down. They don't even put up the fight because they've been broken before the fight has begun. Bertrand Russell, who coined the phrase better red than dead, which if you think about it is in itself nothing short of psychological warfare in one sentence. What a great sentence. I mean, think about it. The psychological warfare just in that one sentence, and how many people were convinced just by that one sentence, better red than dead. Psychological warfare. In 1913, in his book, The Impact of Silence on Society, he wrote these words, quote, "I think the subject which will be of most importance is mass psychology." Then later he wrote, "It may be hoped that in time anybody will be able to persuade anybody of anything if he can catch the patient young and is provided by the state with the money and equipment. This subject will make great strides when it is taken up by scientists under a scientific dictatorship. The populace will not be allowed to know how its convictions were generated. When the technique has been perfected, every government that has been in charge of education for a generation will be able to control its subjects securely without the heed of armies or policemen." What Bertrand Russell was describing was the same thing Sun Tzu talked about 2,500 years previously. A very effective, inexpensive, low casualty battle plan. Psychological warfare. And how is it accomplished? Well, it's accomplished by propaganda. And what do you think, or I should say, what do you think that political correctness is all about? It's propaganda. It's all a part of today's psychological warfare. And don't we have today thought police on our campuses, high school and college alike? I had a man and his son come through from North Dakota this week that I had breakfast with a couple mornings ago. His son related to his 16-year-old son who was still in high school, related to how he had said to one of his teachers in a discussion outside the classroom that he believed that God wanted women to be in the home. She slapped him with detention. Thought police. While at the same time, a girl who was next to him called him a male chauvinist pig. And the same teacher ignored what she said. It's called thought police. It's called psychological warfare being played even upon our children today in the education systems. Why? Well, if you can police the masses' thinking, you don't have to worry about policing the people's actions. And it works both ways, people. It works both ways. That's not an ungodly principle. The idea of thought police. You know, that's not ungodly. The Antichrist have simply borrowed it from Yeshua. Let me read from Matthew chapter 15. In verses 18 and 19, where it says, "But the things that proceed out of the mouth come from the heart, and those defile the man. For out of the heart come evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witness, and slanderers." Doesn't God tell us to guard the heart? In other words, control the heart of the people, and you'll control their actions. Psychological warfare can be played both ways. At least for the most part, it's just been played by one side. But it's time we engage the battle. Now, how is propaganda spread by our enemies? Well, by propagandists called media militia. Now, that's what the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion called them. Now, in 1897, when the first Zionist Congress convened, from which the Protocols originate, there were no radios, TVs, or movie theaters. Consequently, in Protocol 12, Article 13, they were just called newspaper militia. He was talking about media militia. But why did they use the word militia, a military term? Well, because they understood that the media, as propagandists, was a branch of their military, an integral part of their plan for world conquest, which is what the Protocols are all about. That's why you will find a large portion, if not the biggest biggest portion in the protocols that it's devoted to media and education, control, and manipulation. Because they understood, especially those people, they don't like to engage in physical warfare. They'd much rather conquer us, I'll guarantee, by psychological warfare. And so they were considered the media, the newspaper men, and what we have today is radio men and TV men. They're considered a militia in this psychological warfare that's taking place. You see, Christianity's enemies understand that we are in a war, whether Christians today, for the most part, do or not. And they also understand the benefits of psychological warfare. Until Christianities understand the same, I guarantee we're probably doomed to defeat. We have got to understand. Let us understand, first of all, that we are indeed in a war. Revelations chapter 12 and verse 17, we find these words. It says, "And the dragon," and I believe the dragon is today the Babylonian system that's over us now. It's the Babylonian system, the quote-unquote Babylonian system that's over any Christian people of their day and age. And it says, "And the dragon was enraged with the woman and went off to make war with the rest of her offspring who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Yeshua." Note that even the dragon, the Babylonian system, understands the importance of us holding to the commandments of Yahweh and holding to Yeshua the Christ. You can't have one without the other. I don't know that they're that concerned about those who claim Yeshua but who throw away the commandments at the same time. Just an extra thought there. But they understood, and that's who they come to war against. What kind of war are we in? We'll turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 10. 2 Corinthians chapter 10. Verses 3 through 5, we find these words. It says, "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but divinely powerful for the destruction of fortresses. We are destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God, and we are taking every thought captive to the obedience of the Christ." Catch that last phrase there too. It says that we are taking every thought captive, or at least we should be, every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. Sounds like thought police again to me. At least thought police from the right perspective. Also, let me read those same verses from the Amplified Version. It says, "For that we walk, live in the flesh, we are not carrying on our warfare according to the flesh and using mere human weapons or only human weapons. For the weapons of our warfare are not physical weapons of flesh and blood, but they are mighty before God for the overthrow and destruction of strongholds. Inasmuch as we refute arguments and theories and reasonings and every proud and lofty thing that sets itself up against the true knowledge of God, and we lead every thought and purpose away captive into the obedience of Christ, the Messiah, the Anointed One." That is primarily describing psychological warfare. In other words, God intends us to be experts in this very thing rather than being victims of it. We are in a war. There is no question. Turn to 1 Timothy 1 and verse 18. 1 Timothy 1 and verse 18, it says, "This command I entrust to you, Timothy, my son, in accordance with the prophecies previously made concerning you, that by them you may fight the good fight." I believe the King James says, "War, a good warfare." We're in a war over and over and over again. I'm just using a few. But there are several examples in the New Testament that indicate that the Christian walk, the Christian life, is indeed a warfare. And people, if we can't see in this day and age that we're in a war, we are indeed a very, very blind people. Christianity has been attacked. I doubt that there's been any age that Christianity has been as vehemently attacked as it is in the day and age in which we live. We are in a war. But Timothy, and I'm sure if Paul was writing it to us, he'd write the same words, that we're to war, a good warfare. We're to fight, a good fight. But how many people give up before the fight has even begun? Or before they've even begun to fight? We're admonished to fight, to war, a good warfare. Well, how does one fight a good fight in this war in which we are in? Well, first, it's by keeping faith. It's by not succumbing to the fears so often that are uncalled for, unwarranted. because of things that will never happen in the first place. First, we're to keep the faith. Listen again. It says, Paul, writing again at the end of verse 1, he says, that by them you may fight the good fight, verse 19, keeping faith and a good conscience, which some have rejected and suffered shipwreck in regard to their faith. It wouldn't surprise me, he goes on to name a couple in the next couple of verses, that they lost their faith simply because of the fear of what was going on around them. They suffered shipwreck. They were found discarded off on the shores of the violent sea of persecution, or what may have even only been supposed persecution in their minds. But they were found adrift or afloat or shipwrecked along the shores of Christianity because they lost their faith. We fight a good fight first by maintaining our faith. We also fight a good fight by becoming good propagandists ourselves. Listen to these definitions of propaganda and propagandism and propagandist. First, from the Webster's 1828 dictionary. Listen to these definitions because I think we can learn from them. Here, it's interesting. I'm also going to share with you the definitions from the New Collegiate Webster's, well, Webster's New Collegiate Dictionary as well, and it's interesting to note the difference here, but I think we can learn from both of them. From Webster's 1828, it says, under propagandism, it says, the art or practice of propagating tenets or principles. Under propagandist, it says, a person who devotes himself to the spread of any system of principles. Under propagate, part of it says, to spread, to extend, to impel, or continue forward. To spread from person to person, to extend, to give birth to, or originate and spread, as to propagate a story or report. And then lastly, to carry from place to place, to extend by planting. What did they do? They went and planted churches, did they not? And establishing in places before destitute as to propagate the Christian religion. That's the definitions from Webster's 1828. We can also learn from Webster's New Collegiate Dictionary as well. Under propaganda, at one point it says this, the spreading of ideas, information, or rumor for the purpose of helping or injuring an institution, a cause, or a person. Ideas, facts, or allegations spread deliberately to further one's cause or to damage an opposing cause. Under propagandism, it says, the action, practice, or art of propagating doctrines or of spreading or employing propaganda. And then under propagate, it says, to cause, to spread out, and to affect a greater number or a greater area. And then under propagation, it says, to increase in numbers, the spreading of something as a belief abroad or into new regions, dissemination, enlargement, or extension. That's what propagation is all about, propagating. We can learn from those. There's much, matter of fact, to be learned from by those definitions. Proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom of Yahshua the Christ. Well, what do you think that is? It's preaching one kingdom over and against all other kingdoms. It's propagandism. And it's our major means in Christianity, once again, taking dominion. At least in the initial stages, it's a war of words. And either we will fear their words, or they will fear ours. Ezekiel, we need to learn from what Yeshua commands Ezekiel in chapter 2 and verses 6 and 7. He says, and you, son of man, neither fear them nor fear their words. We have so many people shrinking from simply what they say, let alone what they do. But he told Ezekiel, he says, you, son of man, neither fear them nor fear their words. Though thistles and thorns are with you, and you sit on scorpions, neither fear their words nor be dismayed at their presence. And then it says, but you shall speak my words to them, whether they listen or not. You know, I prefer that they fear ours, or that is, those we speak on behalf of God, rather than we fearing theirs. You know, we must learn ourselves to be effective in psychological warfare, first through faith, to overcome the enemy's psychological attacks, and maybe even more importantly, to overcome our own fears. And then second, we must ourselves become experts in propagandism. Let us not forget that the giants we fear are only giants in our own imaginations. It just depends from whose perspective you're viewing things. From our perspective, it may appear that we sometimes face giants. However, from God's perspective, all the inhabitants of the earth are grasshoppers. Let us confidently, courageously, faithfully fight the good fight. To war we go. Raise the trumpet, loudly blow. Warn your kinsmen, let them know. Draw the sword and bend the bow, armed with faith, to war we go. Our foundation is the rock, protecting from the aftershock of wrath to come on those who mock the final tick's prophetic clock. Seek the right, turn from the wrong, praise His name in prayer and song. To reach His called, His arm is long, His mighty hand exceeding strong. Proclaim His kingdom loud and clear, spread good news for all to hear. Conceal not your neighbor's ear, proclaim His name both far and near. Our goal, His kingdom, precious place, so fight the battle, run the race. Believe His Son and seek His face, your twin companions, law and grace. To miss this voyage you can't afford, the ship is sailing, climb aboard. Bend the bow and draw the sword, for kingdom come when all's restored. Raise the trumpet, loudly blow, warn your kinsmen, let them know. Draw the sword and bend the bow, armed with faith, to war we go. Let's stand and close in prayer. Our Heavenly Father, I come before You at this time, and I confess the sins, our sins, and the sins of our forefathers. For when we have feared, when we have created something, quote-unquote, out of nothing, and feared their words rather than fearing You, when we've failed to engage in the battle, when we failed to engage in war, when we failed to fight the good fight, and we succumbed, Father, to our fears, forgive us. Help us to be strong and faithful, knowing that it's our faith that overcomes this world order, and that indeed the victory will be ours and is already ours if we'll only practice our faith. Let us have faith, and let us practice our faith, and let it bring glory, praise, and honor to You in all that we do. We ask these things and we praise You in Yeshua the Christ. Amen.